I'm Monica Taylor, and I'm delighted today to reconnect with my old colleague and friend, Emeritus Professor Larry Walker, and to do this conversation, have this conversation with you, Larry, which is going to be wide-ranging and difficult to cover all the ground that you yourself have covered in the various aspects of your work as an academic scholar, in your professional service, especially with our two connected points of the Association for Moral Education and Journal of Moral Education, your multifarious inputs. But we'll try to unpick some of the main themes. And get to the central concerns that have engaged you in your 40 plus year professional life. In fact, if I may allude to this in passing, I remembered that you wholeheartedly wrote in support. As one of my three referees for when I received the Kumerka Career Award in 2006. And you referred in that letter, which I kept and reread today, that you had, by then in 2006, already known me for over 20 years. Well, we're 20 years on from that, Larry, and we're still working and talking about our work in
And
our
we have a good history.
we do in our and we're still working, as it were, in our different ways in our what you've called semi-retirement. I think that's a good way of describing it. So I guess we must have met first around 40 years ago, when I first attended AME, which was with Dwight Boyd in Toronto in
Yes.
1985. But to be very honest,
85.
pardon?
85.
85, yes. But to be honest, I have no clear memory of you as I do of him, probably because he was center stage. That's all by the by, really, because despite your being a psychologist and my background being in philosophy, we've had many good, important professional and personal conversations over these years, though, as we acknowledge today, not so much latterly because we're in our semi-retirement years.
Right.
So I want to start really where in a way we all begin, your early life. And I'm wondering about your early family life, partly because you've sometimes mentioned to me your mother. And I think, if I remember correctly, you might have told me that your father was a Brit. Also because you've written a lot about family, the role of the family in moral development. So I'm imagining your early family life in New Brunswick was important to you and may have had some influence on you in terms of your interest in moral values.
Absolutely.
Yeah, would you like to say how?
I'd love to talk about my family. You're quite right about my father. He was a child in London along with his brother when the Blitz began. And they were first evacuated to the countryside, as many London children were. And then he and his brother were evacuated to Canada as child evacuees, and they were taken in by a widow who had had no children of her own. In other words, she had no idea what she was getting into. And she took in these two pre-adolescents and looked after them during the war. And my grandparents came over to Canada in 1947. So I have those English roots from my father. On my mother's side, one of my sisters became interested in genealogy and has traced back our roots to about 1630, when on both paternal and maternal sides of my mother's family, they came from England to settle in what is now New England. And the history is that they both settled in Nova Scotia in around 1760, before the American Revolution, but after the British had driven the French out of North America and were looking for settlers to occupy. So I have deep English roots. I grew up in a family of eight children, which even that time ago was a large family. I'm the second born. And among my younger siblings, there are two sets of twins. So, and they were adjacent, just under 2 years apart. So I grew up in a home where the older kids had a lot of responsibility for making a large family function. And in retrospect, I have no regrets about the large family and the expectations for responsibility that I had as a child. I grew up in a devout Christian family, which certainly has formed my life in many ways. And I think that's one of the reasons I became interested in moral development.
I didn't know about the Christian underpinnings, but something in your documentation, which you shared with me in a very organized way, which I've come to expect from you, Larry, and you made it easy for me, put the way you put things together. Made me think, oh, about that, the possible Christian background, because if I remember rightly from what I read but didn't dwell on, you have some involvements in various theological journals or organizations.
Most certainly. I was the chair of the board of a theological college here in Vancouver on the university campus for about 5 years, and I've served on the senate of another theological college for probably 20, 25 years. I mean, those have been important service opportunities for me. But I have been interested in my scholarly work in a little bit in the relationship between faith and morality. So I suppose that has arisen through my early upbringing as well.
Yes, interesting, isn't it? How it carries through sometimes, not with everybody, of course, but sometimes.
Right.
So you've been doing the service part of that alongside your paid professional work, as it were, at UBC. Now, before we get you to UBC, you studied in New Brunswick, you told me in your CV,
Yes.
and did a BA in psychology, interestingly, with a minor in philosophy. And then you went on to do an MA in experimental psychology. Do you think what made you interested in to want to study psychology? Because it's a or it probably was still then. I mean, over here, it was not a natural successor, nor was philosophy, to being at secondary school, because those were not subjects studied in the curriculum. So,
Right.
if that was the case with you in New Brunswick, can you say what drew you to it?
So I think I was initially drawn to the applied aspects of psychology, particularly clinical psychology. Had a little bit of exposure to that in my master's program, and then quickly decided that was not how my life was going to unfold. I did not enjoy the clinical experience I had at all, but was drawn to the research. If I could, I'd like to put it into historical context because I think it does explain my trajectory a bit. In the early 1970s, when I was an undergraduate in psychology, the field was dominated by behaviorism and social learning theory. And in fact, my undergraduate honors thesis was really a test of social learning theory. But I did it using moral judgment as the object of my intervention. And once I began to explore the moral judgment, moral development literature, I realized that this is an area of psychology which is meaningful to me, whereas behaviorism and social learning theory was not meaningful. In fact, of course, with B.F. Skinner's work, he was quite explicit. There's no such thing as morality. And so I think, like most people, I wanted to do research on and to spend a career doing something meaningful. And I quickly switched from an interest in Piaget's theory, which was still thriving at the time, and I discovered Kohlberg's theory in the early 1970s, and that formed my interest in the early part of my career quite extensively. My early training at the University of New Brunswick, which, by the way, is the oldest public university in North America, that doesn't impress people in Europe, but it's impressive here. I got very strong training in experimental methodology. And that was one of the things for which I have been very grateful because I think one of my strengths over the years has been my methodological and statistical competence. And if I've been able to make a contribution to the field of moral development and moral functioning, I think much of it has arisen because of that particular strength that I at first acquired at the University of New Brunswick.
Yes, that's interesting. I mean, I wouldn't be able for one moment to comment on your statistical competence, but the methodological aspects have been varied and stringent, I think. And you've often, well, I can think of in certain respects being critical of other people and their methodologies or lack of them. I think we'll probably come on to that later, but these initial forms of training and so on stay with us, I think, if we get anything from them. What you went after your MA, Larry, in New Brunswick, you went over to Toronto, continuing your journey, well, starting your journey westwards, really, across Canada.
That's true.
And you were at the University of Toronto for between 76 and 70. That doesn't seem long enough, 2 years for a university.
I was quite applied in getting my doctorate, and I didn't face many obstacles. And yes, I finished that in 2 years.
What was
The
that about? What topic?
so Monica, you may remember that at the time there was quite a strong effort in promoting moral education in Ontario, and there were quite a few people there, and that was one of the reasons that I was drawn to the University of Toronto to work with that. I had published on Kohlberg when I was in my master's program, and my PhD dissertation continued along the same lines. And I, in my dissertation research, was trying to demonstrate that development through the stages, Kohlberg stages in particular, of moral development required certain cognitive and perspective-taking prerequisites. And I simply was aligning these different stage models and making the point that moral development depends upon certain cognitive understandings and various degrees of perspective taking. I mean, before you can universalize principles, there are certain understandings about other people and groups of people and certain cognitive operations that are necessary. And that's what my dissertation work was about. Larry Kohlberg was the external examiner on my dissertation, which was helpful in getting his attention. And
What did he
we,
have to say? Do you remember?
well, there's a, there's a, there was a little crisis because he didn't show up. He was in Toronto, and I scheduled my doctoral defense for a time when he was in Toronto, and he was receiving an award from the American Psychological Association, which was meeting in Toronto that year. And he didn't show up, which in retrospect is not surprising. But one important member of my supervisory committee was Dwight Boyd, who had worked with Kohlberg, and he tracked Kohlberg down and got him to scribble out some comments about my dissertation, which were sufficient to help me pass my defense.
That all sounds very typical from what we, well, from what I later knew.
Yes. So Dwight what rescued me there with that one, and he was terribly important. Because I was studying Kohlberg's theory, to be a member of my committee and give me good critical feedback.
Because he was already in the philosophy department at OISE.
That's correct.
Yes, and he would have had contacts by then with the people who were doing empirical work, let's say more practical work in moral education.
Yes.
Yes, across Ontario, not just in Toronto.
Right.
Yeah,
Yes.
yeah. And I remember some of those newsletters that came out. That was part of my early awareness when I myself got into moral education and began editing the JME in 76. Yes, it's 15 years ago.
Congratulations.
Now, I only realized that the other day. As one is always sort of pressing forward rather than looking back, though I find myself doing these historical tasks, which is interesting because I'm not in any way normally a historian, but the social and what shall I call it? Well, Angela called it academic genealogy. And I didn't.
Yes.
So that's what I'm involved in, but seems to have become something I've taken up. I suppose we all reflect a bit more in our twilight years. But so we've got you to Toronto, a very quick PhD. Were you snapped up by UBC? How did that come about?
Well, as I was finishing up my PhD, I put out lots of applications. One of the places that was of interest to me was UBC. When I received an offer from another institution, I called them up and said, because this was the days of paper and telephone at best,
Yes.
I called them up and said, I'm just wondering how your search is going. And they said, well, we've filled the position. And I said, thank you very much. And I took a position, a 1 year position at the University of Winnipeg. A couple of weeks after I signed my contract with Winnipeg, UBC called back and said, are you still available? And I said, no, I've agreed to take a position at Winnipeg. And they said, if we fill the position temporarily, would you consider next year? And I said yes. And indeed, they offered me the position the following year. So that was 1979.
Yes.
And so that's where I've spent my career.
Well, you were both so both parties were very moral, if you we might say. You kept your word and your contract with Winnipeg, and UBC kept its word and offered you a post the following year.
Well, there was a competition the following year, and I knew that there would be, but obviously they found my work interesting.
Yeah.
I had a very happy career at UBC.
Well, you've been there 40 years. Well, 40 years till your retirement, Larry, and another, what, seven coming up, six or seven since, where you're still involved. I'm sure we'll talk about that later towards the end.
Right.
But so as you've set out, you covered. You rose through the ranks, right? You've had a very involved career where UBC is, and we should say the psychology department, right, has been your
Yes.
home base. And
Yes.
I'm wondering, two questions. I must make these clear before we go on to discuss more of what you've been involved in. I guess having a home base where presumably you felt comfortable, or you would have had opportunities to change and go elsewhere, could be a great strength, because it's one thing less to think about. You know, that's where you work and that's what you do, what you want, you know, what you do. Or it could be constraining, if you can't make opportunities. So I suppose one question is, did you feel comfortable there? Were you allowed to make your own opportunities, or to what extent did you have to, perhaps in the early years, of course, do what powers be wanted you to do? And related to that is, how common is it for psychologists of your caliber to remain in the same institution for a 40-year career?
Well, I think I've been fortunate in beginning in a tenure track position and then being able to advance through the ranks. a lot of universities now save money by hiring a lot of part-time lecturers, which is sort of a dead-end way to live. So I've been fortunate that way. But in terms of, was I comfortable in my department? Absolutely. I had very supportive colleagues in my area of the department. I was technically in the developmental psychology area. The department was always supportive of me and encouraging of me. I mean, the great thing is that essentially I taught what I wanted to teach, and I did research on what interested me. And the only expectation was that you be competent and effective in the classroom. You're a productive scholar that's having some sort of impact. And of course, that you're a good citizen of the university and do the service and represent the university well. But I mean, being a faculty member at a research intensive university is I think the sweetest job there is, because the fulfillment you get from doing what you want to do makes other aspects of the job sort of trivial and unimportant. So great flexibility. Was I recruited elsewhere? Yes, particularly US opportunities were offered to me, but I think I'm a loyal Canadian and was comfortable and happy living in Canada, living in Vancouver. And maybe I perseverate too much, but no, I have no regrets spending my career at UBC. The downside of that is that in a context where salaries are set or influenced mostly by threats to leave,
Oh, yes.
I didn't want to play that game. And so I was appropriately compensated, but probably not as well as colleagues who were playing that game,
Yes, and
of
people
which I
who
have no bitterness.
and people who moved around. It's a bit like people who are constantly moving house.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I one observation about that. You were interested in Kolberg's work on in developmental psychology and moral development, but you were never part of his in-group, shall we say, were you? You didn't actually study at Harvard with him, as did
No.
White, for example, who you've mentioned, or Fritz Oser, or any of those people, Anne Higgins, whom I've had a conversation with. You were not part of that inner circle in any higher degree or research sense, I think.
That's correct. And I appreciated that I had the liberty to examine Kolberg's approach from an outsider's perspective without any sort of apparent conflict of interest. I think that was valuable to me. I was fascinated by his theory and by its implications. And one of the reasons was that he was making extremely strong claims about the nature of morality and the nature of moral development and nature of interventions. And I believed that they were claims that should be tested and examined empirically. And as I sort of was implying earlier, I thought I could bring some methodological strengths to examining some of those things that were At that point, more of a casual claim rather than one that we could put to empirical test. And so, I mean, the first few years of my career really were devoted to examining claims about the hierarchical nature of the stages, the sequentiality of the stages, the role of cognitive disequilibrium in promoting development. I was interested a bit in the universality claims of his model, and so on.
Well, one of the six publications you kindly sent me and which you chose to reflect on in this conversation, you'll recall I asked you to identify six publications which were most personally satisfying, accorded. Sorry, were academically well received and/or influenced research or practice, and they're not all the they're not the same things, as I'm sure you'll agree. And I imagine this was a huge challenge because you've listed over 100 publications and in different journals, at least 10 of which I noted happily were in the JME over a 20-year period, and 5 in other Taylor and Francis journals, but in a very wide range of journals. And one of these six publications, which you said are listed roughly in the order in which the topics became your research focus over your career, was in 1996, Kolberg's Cognitive Developmental Contributions to Moral Psychology in a journal called World Psychology. And you critiqued his work for its philosophical emphasis on justice, its psychological emphasis on cognitive function, its reliance on hypothetical dilemmas. I'm wondering if you'd like to say a bit more about that, given that we started talking about Kolberg's work and how interested, fascinated you were by it.
Well, I think after several years of examining Kolberg's approach, I began to see some of the limitations in it. And I mean, essentially, I was growing up and acquiring my own voice on some of these things. And I certainly wasn't the first or only one to have these concerns. I mean, the use of hypothetical dilemmas was sort of the hallmark of his approach, but it very much is one that focuses on people's ability to make moral judgments and to articulate the reasons for them. It reflects the cognitive bias of his approach, or the cognitive emphasis of his approach. And of course, that all rolls into the emphasis on justice as being the core of morality. So those are all a package in a way. And I and many other people recognized that there's more to morality. In fact, this may not be the core at all. I mean, that's still a debatable question. It certainly is the aspect of morality that is most philosophically informed. That certainly was one of the reasons I was interested in the approach. But as I think we know, there are a variety of philosophical approaches to morality, and the Kantian approach that Rawls' approach that framed Kohlberg's theory isn't the only way to consider morality. And so those were all prompts that were helping to move the field along. I mean, part of the impetus for that was the little bit of cross-cultural research that I was fortunate to be involved in. And it just made me realize, stepping out of my North American Western worldview, that there were other important ways to think about morality.
Yes, I noted. It was a reminder that your, I think I'm right in saying your first published paper in JME with a colleague whose name I've forgotten was actually about moral reasoning in a communist Chinese society.
Yes, well, that this badly dates me, but indeed, this was research that was conducted in the PRC before Tiananmen Square, and where we accessed different populations of Chinese people without official approval.
Yes.
And that was sort of key because at the time, if you wanted to conduct research in China, you were told who you would have access to, and that's not what we wanted. So we had a collaborator in China whose identity I do not know, who did interviews for us and translated them and explained some of the content of the interviews to us. No surprises there, but the fact that Confucian morality still was running strong in the Chinese approach to morality was one of the important things, and filial piety, and so on. But it was interesting in that study that we found that Kohlberg's model could detect meaningful differences across different groups that we had accessed. That was helpful, but at the other end, it was just missing things that were obviously important in Chinese morality.
So you had quite some learning from that investigation then, of learning of different kinds.
Yes. Well, confirming what you already know is sort of boring. You want to be surprised by your research, right? You want to find things that are not easily explained. Otherwise, it's just mechanical work. I mean, I was always trying to prove that Kohlberg was wrong. I mean, you don't want to confirm, you want to test. So the two cross-cultural studies that we did one in a complex, advanced, that's the wrong word, perhaps, communist society. The other cross-cultural study we did among a gatherer fishing group in Papua New Guinea who had minimal contact with the Western world.
Oh, yes.
And boy, did they have some interesting things to say about morality that Kohlberg's model just had no comment on.
Yeah, just glanced off their responses.
Yeah. So, I mean, sorcery was a very powerful theme in their thinking and in their acting. And we think of that as a very primitive way of thinking about morality, but actually, it's a rather sophisticated means of social control or moral control in that context, because it's not something that an individual does to another person. It's something that the community imposes on someone who has morally offended.
Yes.
And the community, it's a patriarchal society, would be the village elders. And in that context, then, the village elders would sit around in a circle and someone would share a moral problem that was going on. Someone was stealing from someone else, someone was committing adultery. And he would describe the case, and then the next person, the man beside him, would paraphrase what the first man had said and added his would add his own. And then the third person would paraphrase the first two and add his own. And they go around the circle until they're saying the same thing. They do not debate.
Oh, so it was quite an iterative process.
And strongly communitarian,
Yes.
it's important in these small societies to preserve community amity, as they would say, goodwill. Whereas in a Western individualistic society,
Yeah, we
if
don't
we're
care.
having a problem with our neighbor over the fence or something, we threaten to sue them or whatever, but there's no attempt to resolve these disputes without conflict. So it was something that didn't fit the individualistic framework of Kohlberg's model.
Indeed. And I know this has been much discussed and debated, and even to ask you this question is to simplify, but we're constrained, you haven't got your 40 years of and all your publications to read. But on balance now, looking at all of that as a framework, a stage model of moral development, do you believe, if believe is the right word, or if you might want to replace that word, that verb, with think, there is development, progression, or change? And what's your considered view now, looking back on all of that?
Oh, I certainly think that there is progressive developmental change in people's ability to reason about moral problems. Absolutely. And I don't think it's a mistake to characterize that development in stage-like terms. I mean, the evidence I generated over the years was that reasoning seems to develop through these phases or stages. They're sloppier, perhaps, and more amenable to influence than perhaps first stated. But I think it's a good way to capture how individuals at different levels of development will typically approach moral reasoning problems. But reasoning is not all there is to morality.
No, indeed.
And in
Sorry.
various ways, I tried to test that and to make it obvious. One of the ways you haven't asked me, but I'm going to switch to talk about parenting,
Yes.
because
Good.
as a parent, I began to recognize that Kohlberg's model was missing a lot of things, and there's more to parenting in the moral domain than just reasoning. And effective parenting techniques are not the ones that would follow from his model.
Oh.
Peer debate that might work in a classroom. Turns out to be fairly destructive when it's something that a parent does.
Oh, you mean the sort of plus one reasoning approach?
Well, I'm happy with plus one. What I wasn't happy with Well, that's the wrong way to phrase it. The evidence did not support the view that parents who strongly challenge their children's view is an effective way to stimulate their development. And that's because parents have overwhelming power. And they are going to be much more effective. I did a 5-year longitudinal study. They're going to be much more effective if they essentially take a Socratic approach. If they ask good questions rather than lecturing, to put it in blunt terms. And children are much more likely to accept a moral framework when it seems to come out of their mouth than whether it comes out of a parent's mouth. So I found that quite compelling. And also that part of the effectiveness of what parents did had to involve support. So encouragement and support rather than a coldness to the interactions or hostility in some way.
Or being too authoritative
Yes,
authoritarian, I should
a
say.
more authoritarian, but yes, authoritarian parents seem to stymie children's development in my research. I was quite impressed by the parents who were smart enough to hold their tongue and ask good questions.
What did you find? Did you learn about that personally, Larry, compared with your own upbringing and your upbringing of your own children?
Well, that's a good question. Can I share an anecdote?
Please.
My daughter took one of my university courses, and this was a large lecture class, probably about 100 students, and I had teaching assistants who did the marking, so there was no or minimal conflict of interest. And I had been lecturing about parenting styles and so on. And one student piped up and asked, Dr. Walker, have you used any of these techniques with your own children? And I said, yes, I think I did quite a bit. And they said, and how did your kids turn out? And I was able to say to this classroom of students that I have two wonderful children of whom I'm very proud, with my daughter sitting there, unbeknownst to the other students. So that was a delight for me to be able to do. But many of the techniques that I and my wife used with our kids are ones that we now see our own children using in their parenting. And it's just taking the child's perspective and trying to understand the world from the way they see it and trying to get them to think critically about what they're doing. And it's hard not to solve parenting problems by using your power, but because using your power in the short term is very effective. I mean, you as a bigger, more powerful person who controls resources, you can force your children to do things that, but that doesn't mean they're going to accept the wisdom that you're trying to impart. So,
No, it could be very counterproductive, in fact.
absolutely, absolutely.
And I believe, if I may say this, if I remember correctly, you mentioned to me that your wife was a head teacher. And so is that right?
It is. She was the principal of what we call a middle school here in North America.
So did you ever have any conversations with her about parenting style with respect to moral values development in the home and the school's way of dealing with moral education. I mean, that made you reflect about any of the issues you were interested in a more, scholarly research way.
That's a great question. My wife Edith and I have slightly different styles and always have had slightly different styles and parentings, and hopefully we have complemented each other. It's interesting how we each other characterize these styles. I would describe her as more permissive than me. She would say that she is more flexible than I am. I would say that I'm principled. She would say that I'm rigid. So these are different sides of the same coin, but I certainly consistency would have been my strong suit. Compassion would have been her strong suit.
Yeah, interesting. I found myself changing, not with respect to experience of parenting, of which I have none, about the notion of consistency. I used to think that was a great virtue, and now I've come to question that quite a bit more with the passing of time and changes in society and all those sorts of things.
Well, consistency by the doer may not be the same as the consistency as seen by the receiver.
Indeed. Yes, indeed. And you told me, well, in fact, you kindly put it on your profile, which our listeners, if there be any, will see, that you now have seven grandchildren. And I wonder, with respect to them, and you told me earlier that you're closely involved with at least some of them who live nearby. Do you see yourself now having learnt from some of your mistakes, if there were any in your parenting? Perhaps there weren't. Or do you see yourself in an ongoing way learning from the interaction with your grandchildren? And is it different from your interaction with your children with respect to moral learning?
Great question. I would say the role of a grandparent is quite different than that of a parent. And I would hate to be a parent now. I think it's much tougher. The pressures on children's lives are quite different now than they were even a generation ago, particularly with social media. We've been very fortunate to have children and their spouses who are good, effective parents, and we have felt no compulsion to intervene or even to give advice, which is a delightful position to be in. And I recognize that not all grandparents and parents have that luxury. Of course, each of our children have spouses that come from different backgrounds and have slightly different styles, but I think every couple has their dance around these things, and they learn how to work together to promote a common goal.
Yes, well, that's the important thing, isn't it? The teamwork and the working together.
Well, I think parental conflict is probably one of the most destructive things for children's development that there can be. I think in almost all relationship there's some measure of conflict, but how children are affected by that should be upmost in people's minds.
You did made a great contribution to our field by writing about moral development and education in the family. You also, I think we must deal with a couple of other themes, one of which was about gender, right? Morality. And you had several papers published about gender and moral reasoning and sex differences. I think there was one particularly in child development which was reprinted several times in different collected volumes, one of which was that handbook by Curtiens and Giewirth, right?
Right.
And they in themselves were very controversial, weren't they, in our field?
They were, and perhaps rightly so, but the paper to which you referred, the Child Development Review paper, was published when I was very junior, before I had attained tenure, and I had no idea how controversial it would be. But that review paper is my most highly cited paper and reflects how controversial the issue was. Of course, the context is that Carol Gilligan, in particular, made claims about bias in Kohlberg's theory and in several other theories of personality and developmental psychology. I knew, having worked in the Kohlberg's area for a few years, that her claim was not correct. And so I did the systematic review, which was updated over time. Her claim was that Kohlberg's model downscores females in stage of moral development. And the review, which other people have done in various ways, turns out not to be true. And that was controversial. Of course, that wasn't her only claim. She claimed that women speak in a different voice, and in particular, speak in a voice of care and responsibility rather than one of justice. And her evidence in her book was anecdotal. And so over the years, I was one of many people who tried to test this notion. And I found it was not true when people reason about hypothetical dilemmas, which are standardized and standard dilemmas. But in some cases, it was true when people reason about real life dilemmas from their own experience. Which made me think, is that actually all that surprising, given that men and women have different social lives and social responsibilities? And so when you analyze the content of the real life dilemmas, you realize that it's the nature of the dilemma that reflects the orientation that is being used and not the sex of the individual who's talking. I see this as much more helpful for women's cause than than Gilligan's view, that reinforces traditional stereotypes about men and women. I
Yes,
don't,
it does. Yes, it does.
because if the sort of reasoning we use is a reflection of the issue or the situation we're in, then it's not something inherent that defines people. So I thought that was helpful. A helpful contribution, and it's been replicated by others many times. But in both cases, I was doing what I thought was methodologically sound research regarding claims that had been advanced on the basis of anecdotal evidence.
Yes, you were very critical of her, in quotes, methods and her claims. And you returned to that. I mean, of course, her work was also, we should say, in a situation, context of feminism.
Absolutely. And
And that made a big difference, really, because people were just sort of speaking out. Well, we won't say, I think it's what's referred to as the second wave of feminism now.
yes.
But people were, some people, myself included to some extent then, were coming within that sort of way of looking at things for the first time. And so people were, people, women, were developing a voice, myself included, partly on the strength of that, though I never saw myself as an out and out feminist. But she was working in that context, so we have to acknowledge that also, I think. And
Right.
then, and sorry, you might want to say something about that.
Yes. So just because though I found that those empirical claims could not be established, that doesn't mean that I don't think she made a very strong contribution. And which those contributions were influential in my own work. One is her advocacy for using real life rather than hypothetical dilemmas. It turned out in my research to be highly informative of the moral issues that people face and what they consider to be a moral issue, which
Yes,
turns
what
out
they
to be
counted.
important as well.
Yeah, what they counted. Yeah, rather than having somebody else tell them
Right.
what was a moral dilemma, they could easily produce some of their own, if not dilemmas, then, you know, situations, episodes, relationships that had made
Right.
them pause to think and review their thinking and behavior.
So over the years, I'm just guessing, but easily did 1,000 interviews with people where I asked them about a real life dilemma from their own experience. And all the time, I was blown away by what people explained was a dilemma for them and what they said was not a moral issue. And for some people, I mean, I'd ask, for example, can you relate a recent moral dilemma from your own experience? And some people would say, oh, 60 years ago, I was tempted to shoplift a candy bar at the store. And I'd say, is that the most recent one you've struggled with? And they say, yeah, I haven't had any moral dilemmas. And other people I would ask, can you share a moral dilemma with me? And they'd say, well, today I had this and I had this and I had this and I had this. And they see the world in moral terms. And that has profound implications for individual moral life and our social lives, whether things are understood to have moral implications. And for many ordinary things that we do day by day, there are moral implications involved. And it makes a difference whether you frame these decisions as business decisions or political decisions or strictly personal decisions, or whether this is just a convention that we do that has no moral import and so on. So those real life dilemmas were terribly a terribly important innovation that has been important in
Absolutely. And what I think is interesting, particularly about what you just say, is the difference between people in what they see as a moral issue for them, whether it's one 60 years ago, nothing since, or whether it's several in the course of one day. I hesitate to ask this question because I'm not a psychologist, but what did that tell you about the psyches or the moral selves or whatever one, however one wants to consider it, of these people? Did it give you any pause for thought? I mean, if you're seeing, I mean, I guess we all like to see ourselves moral to some extent. I'll hear by voice in public, something I have occasionally said to other people, sometimes in the field, but more likely to friends when they say, "Well, what were you interested in? What did you do work in?" And I say, "Yeah, moral education." And sometimes they want to sort of take a step back. And then I'll say, well, one of my hypotheses, and I know we both don't always like hypotheses, we like real life stuff, was that people are in it because they have some sense that they need it, right? I've yet to have that disproved or confirmed, but I think we all do like to see ourselves as moral to some degree. And it's good we're conscious of that. But if you're thinking your last moral challenge, as it were, was 60 years ago, or if you're thinking, well, it's got to 7:30 in the evening today, as it is for me, and I've had two or three moral challenges today, that's sort of perhaps not, or things that I would have counted as moral. That's not quite so bad, not so wearing, right, on the
Right.
self. But if you've got all these little episodes that might amount to 20 or 30 episodes that you can recount to somebody who's listening to you, that's pretty wearing, isn't it, in terms of the way you're living your life.
Yeah, a couple responses to that. One is that I think with a little bit of experience and perhaps expertise, many of these daily moral issues are ones that could have been a conflict, but you realized, no, I know exactly what I need to do here. So it's not as if we go through a day of struggling with life and death moral issues. It's just, for many people, they understand the moral implications of things that they do, and they probably are not vexed about these things all day. And I think expertise with moral issues gives you some proficiency there. But there's also the phenomenon of being hypervigilant or hyperjudgmental about morality, or hyperzealous, which I think would make people overly judgmental of others. I think that's the downside of this strong moral awareness, where you're judging every other driver and you're judging every clerk in the store, and because they have failed in some way to meet your moral standards. And I think that's the downside of being hypervigilant about morality.
Yes, and that those instances, if they were to be unpicked further, it could possibly be argued that they were not strong cases of moral negligence.
Right, of course.
Yeah, so.
And I mean, you mentioned this sense of moral self that we have. or at least most people have. If you ask people to classify themselves, whether they're high or low on a personality dimension like extroversion, introversion, you'd find a pretty even split. But if you ask people about intelligence, people would be more likely to say they're above than below intelligence. But if you ask about morality, everyone's well above the average. It's a very, very powerful evaluative dimension of functioning. I mean, even the worst criminals will make the claim that they're highly moral or moral people and blame whatever they got them into trouble on situational factors. It's a very, very, very powerful need. And so that's why we rationalize and explain our moral failures to others when we're prompted, or more typically to ourselves. I mean, the problem is we're smart human beings and we can rationalize quite compellingly.
Yes, indeed. This touches a bit, perhaps a little tangentially, on two of the other publications you noted, and which are more focused on character as such, right? One of them, which I didn't know at all, about paradigm assumptions about moral behavior and empirical battle royal. I think I'm right in saying focus is on moral heroism, and also somewhat different. Your 2019 swan song, if I may call it that, Larry,
Fair
your
enough.
Kohlberg Memorial Lecture. Wise man to go out on a high and not to be tempted back to titivate with special issues and other things that perhaps one should know better not to do.
I certainly was honored to be asked to give the Kohlberg Memorial Lecture, and
I'm
I
surprised you
saw
didn't
it as
do it before.
So that reflected the Kohlberg Memorial Lecture reflected a line of work I've been doing for several years, in which I was trying to engender a more full-bodied account of moral functioning. And I simply, as a first step, and for others to pick up if they're so inclined, I simply found a sample of what we could call ordinary moral exemplars, and studied them intensively, including lengthy personal interviews, and discovered some things about not only their reasoning, but also about their character. And I think it tells us something about moral functioning and what supports moral excellence. These were award winners in the Canadian honors system for volunteerism. And these are just ordinary people who were nominated and vetted for extraordinary long-term volunteerism in support of individuals, families, groups, communities, or humanitarian causes. And found some what I thought were particularly interesting things that flesh out what moral character might look like. For example, I'll give you two examples of finding there. One is that they have an unusual ability to reconcile the competing motives of agency and communion. Traditionally described agency is putting yourself above others, community, or communion is the ability to come alongside and su support others. So to reconcile them, I think, is a powerful motive for good, because these exemplars got their jollies, their fulfillment, by helping others. And they don't see it as a sacrifice. They see it as a pleasure and a joy that they're able to work with the homeless or whatever their cause is. It's not drear duty. It is what they find fulfilling in life. And I think that's what propels that sort of action. The other thing that I found that was interesting was that they, in describing their own life and their own life experiences, had a much higher frequency of what we call redemption themes, where they took a negative experience and found some positive benefit out of it. And that's also a powerful motive if you're working in volunteer situations where things aren't pleasant. You're working at the food bank, or you're working with drug addicts, or you're working with people who are dying, or whatever you're doing. If you can reframe that a bit to see something positive rather than being discouraged by negativity, that helps you to continue. So those are just a couple of things that I found there that were interesting. I had a fantastic time conducting this research. My research grant had abundant funds to send research assistants to do the interviews, but I was selfish and decided to do them all myself. And these were drawn from all provinces of Canada. And so I did a lot of traveling, and I confess to my creation of unnecessary greenhouse gases to do this research. But it was such a privilege to talk to these people and to talk to a matched comparison group, which was one of the methodological strengths of that study.
So, do you think that character is significant, significantly significant in terms of moral action, behavior?
Absolutely. And the other paper you mentioned was trying to tease that apart. Trying to make the point that character does make a difference, and we cannot attribute all of the variability in moral functioning to situational factors. And it goes back to Hannah Arendt's characterization of Eichmann in the aftermath of the Holocaust, where she described the banality of evil. Here's an apparently ordinary man who could have engineered the worst atrocities, which she attributed to situational factors. And psychologists, particularly social psychologists, have picked up that theme and sort of replicated that you could engineer people to do evil things, but you can also engineer people to do good things with situational factors or incentives. And the point of my paper is that, of course, there are situational influences. We're all always processing the influences we're exposed to, but there are characterological differences that clearly arise in analyses of people. And that was the point of that paper, which I wrote using the same type of data as in the other paper I was talking about. So, indeed, there are characterological differences that explain differences between groups, and these differences arise naturally in the data, if I can say it that way, because I had both my exemplars and my matched comparison group. And when you take the large group and say, find the similarities among these people, the exemplars and the comparison group turn out to be quite different groups in terms of their character on several important dimensions. So, yes, I'm a great believer in character. And the question is, what are the developmental roots of many of these character differences? I did ask them about that, the people in my study, about their early life, because I was interested in what they would recall. The problem here is that I don't know exactly what their early life was like, but I know what sense they made of their early life. And having, for example, a mentor or someone who functioned like a mentor early in life was a strong influence in their framing of their own life and what they did. Likewise, being exposed to disadvantage in others in early life sort of helped to prime the pump.
You mean
And of
a sense of injustice or lack of
yes,
fairness or something?
or poverty or need or sickness, whatever, being exposed to that in an early life, and I'm presuming that would often get combined with parenting that would support that exposure and what the response to it should be. And of course, and this goes back to something we were talking about earlier, having morality at the core of your identity, I think, turns out to be important. So some of my exemplars were recipients of the Civilian Award for Bravery. And these are people who had done truly heroic things, risking their own life to save someone else, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, but they had done this obviously moral act. And when I talked to them and interviewed them about their life, almost invariably they denied any heroism. They said anyone would have done what I had done. Although we know that's not true, but it was part of their identity that they would say, well, I couldn't simply watch that car on fire. I had to get in and get that person out. I couldn't have lived with myself otherwise. And so morality or helping is so core to their identity that it informs their action in a powerful way.
Yeah, you see that sometimes on online on news items, don't you? People have
Yes.
been heroic, and they don't seem to have given it a second thought. They've just gone in there and done what needed to be, or what they perceived
Yes.
needed to be done.
Yes. There are, of course, there are situational factors involved in those rescues or heroic events. And if you can't swim, you're not going to help anything by jumping into the water to save someone who's drowning. But if you have some life-saving skills, you've been trained to do what you're competent to do, and it comes automatically. So.
You gave me in what you were saying then earlier a nice segue to something else I want to ask you about. Coming back to your life in the university, really, but also related to all these publications. And that was the word mentorship, the importance of mentorship sometimes in people's backgrounds. You, well, in these six publications, just as take it as an example, three of those you've mentioned were single authored by you, and three with other colleagues. And in your profile, you've very, I would say, characteristically, openly and generously acknowledged the relationship you've had with several of your what were then students. Now, they've become, some of them, about 50-50, I think, professors in universities themselves, or in a private, I assume, clinical psychological practice.
Right.
And you've had not only the influence of your academic work, publications, and over 240 conference presentation. I mean, that's a lot of work. You've had these ongoing sort of sometimes day to day, week to week, month to month, and in many cases, years, even decades, relationship with
Right.
people who have been your students, some of whom, several of whom you've published with, right? So you seem to, you're very open to acknowledge that in a way that I haven't noticed with many other people, though perhaps if one had prodded harder, one would have got some of that, or one has got the occasional person, as it were. But you've got a whole list of these people, many of whom have been very successful, or successful in academic scholarly terms in their own right.
So you've been generous to say that it was my mentorship. I would just say that I was smart enough to recruit students to work with me who had an interest in the work I was doing and to whom I gave considerable freedom to find their own passion in the field. I didn't want someone who's just going to be a research assistant for me. If I'm recruiting a bright grad student, I want to have them share their mind with me. And so my students moved me in ways that I had not intended and opened my eyes to areas of research or to ideas for research that would not have occurred to me.